Notice dated October the 13th, 1967, and it's signed by William J. Jordan. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Jordan took the letter. He read it, I know, and he said the president read it. And mm-hmm. perhaps they took it as a statement that I had made a mistake and signed the letter, which was not intended. It was clarification. Mm-hmm. But he said, the president was pleased to receive your letter and has asked me to respond. We all make mistakes, but all too few of us have the wisdom to regret them and the courage to admit them. Now, here's an important paragraph. The important thing for you and your colleagues at IVS is to go forward with your most important and useful work in helping the Vietnamese people. There is a very real and deep appreciation here for the things that IVS has done and is doing. Now, this is from the White House, mm-hmm. William J. Jordan. Addressed to Mr. Jimmy K. Bigelow, IVS Cords, Advanced Team 21, APO. There it is right there. So the importance, I think, lies in that last paragraph. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Somebody, and perhaps the President of the United States read, and perhaps he asked Mr. Jordan to respond that way, somebody, somewhere, at some time during the war, for a second, realized, and maybe admitted, that the IVS experience, that thing that you and I were talking about, the thing that I was trying to talk about, mm-hmm. the war, the politics were over here, mm-hmm. what was important, this, what we're doing and how we're feeling and what kind of understanding we're giving to each other. And there it is. The importance is what you're doing, you and your colleagues.
And I agree with you completely and share that emotion deeply. Mm-hmm. As a human being, as a historian, I look at the address,
mm-hmm. right.
IVS Cords.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The work you're doing for the Vietnamese people
yeah.
is Cords.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. It doesn't mean anything. Because
mm-hmm.
as a historian, I don't make great meanings uh-huh. out of little pieces of evidence
uh-huh.
unless there are other pieces of evidence. And that's there's so many levels, and a historian's going to look at each level. The bottom line, I think someone said in one of the interviews that despite the war and despite IVS, successes and failures in administration, and despite the politics, despite everything else, there were thousands of human contacts made between IVSers and other NGO people in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and also between some members of the military and individual Vietnamese. And there was also the Vietnamese openness, general openness,
mm-hmm.
and that led to thousands and thousands of contacts which, as a sum of experience, made it possible for the United States to resume relations with Vietnam and find Vietnamese with very affectionate feelings towards the United States, because that's very apparent that exists. When IVSers go back to villages where they're allowed to and everything, people come forward and remember that experience. And, you know, to me, that when that person said that, I said, now that is the most satisfying thing that I've heard, because that means that the real legacy was what was largely the result of what people wanted to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And what they ended up doing, regardless of what their assignment was, that's what they did. Good Americans with good Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
and doing their thing of building that and cementing that relationship. On the other hand, you know, there's this wonderful line at the end of the Maltese Falcon
mm-hmm.
where Humphrey Bogart is sending Mary Astor off to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I love you. And he says, and I love you too. He says, now let's look at the other things. And there's this huge list of things that IVS is subcontracted by USAID
mm-hmm.
to do what? In its nation building. And IVS is interested in nation building, not in counterinsurgency,
mm-hmm.
but nation building is part of the triumvirate of counterinsurgency.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States, the American taxpayer, is not paying for you to become friendly with Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
It should. And it is. Ultimately, that's what's happening with that money.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's not even the money anymore. It's just that IVS exists so that you can go.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, that connection couldn't happen. But ultimately, it's supposed to be cultivating a loyalty to the government. You're actually an employee of the government of South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Republic of Vietnam. And it's designed to create good feelings between Americans and Vietnamese, particularly in contested areas. That is, if you were in an uncontested area, nobody at IVS or USAID cared.
Mm-hmm.
It was only, especially in the Delta
mm-hmm.
and other areas where you got a lot more support. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy about it. It's natural that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a natural thing where if there's a troubled school and a non-troubled school, the squeaky wheel gets the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so it came out that way. And I don't see a dichotomy. I'm sure other people, and unfortunately other people have,
mm-hmm.
seen IVS as, quote, reluctant counterinsurgents. And I don't see that at all in any way.
But I don't either.
Yes, exactly. But there'll always be that dimension to it because of the intentionality of what we were doing in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So that's to set up talking about this letter. Mm-hmm. What about that letter did you agree with that was a cause for you signing it, and for other reasons why you wouldn't sign it?
I haven't read that letter. Mm-hmm. And even though I have it here with me, mm-hmm. Lyndon B. Johnson, and I also have, I believe, here's a copy in Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. This letter is dated September the 1967. Mm-hmm. This is probably the only time that I legitimately got involved politically mm-hmm. in what was going on. And I felt that the efforts, that type of military effort, after having been there for a year, mm-hmm. that type of military, almost any type of military effort, mm-hmm. was doing damage to what was happening, at least in my little realm of the world. Mm-hmm. And not so much that I was felt that my toes were being stepped on and I couldn't do my job, but in my opinion, it wasn't doing any good mm-hmm. to anybody for any reason. Mm-hmm. And it was the strongest statement I guess I made politically, that doggone it, we should stop this foolishness. It's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. It's not, even the Vietnamese people with whom I talk, and I've let my Vietnamese friends read the Vietnamese translation of that letter. Mm-hmm. And their feelings were that they felt that all the bombing in the world would not produce any type of resolution to this war mm-hmm. whatsoever. And they specifically said, if we could have some more IVSers, or if we could have some more people who had the type of intentions that IVS has, they would mention Cu Quan Chi Nguyen Day, which mm-hmm. I believe is the Vietnamese word for IVS. Mm-hmm. That if they had more people like that.
Oh, now you have to spell it.
I know, I'm not even sure if I can.
Okay, go ahead. Oh, it'll probably be in the letter.
It might be.
The Vietnamese, we don't need it, I'll Xerox it.
It might
file.
Be, yeah.
Okay.
So it was one of those few stabs in politics mm-hmm. that I made there. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it really clear. Mm-hmm. I never felt betrayed mm-hmm. by IVS. I never felt betrayed by the Vietnamese, the Mon Chinh Darns. Mm-hmm. I felt very disappointed in my country. Mm-hmm. And even when I felt that it was almost a feeling of shame. Mm-hmm. The Vietnamese never treated me as if I were from a country that was that would be a shameful place from which to come. Mm-hmm. It was a part of what was going on. It was almost as if, I would say, not as if, I would say that the Vietnamese had a greater sense of history mm-hmm. than I mm-hmm. at that young age, and certainly maybe even America could have. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, the Asian culture, mm-hmm. the conflicts with China, the roots way back to, you know, thousands of years, the sense of history, mm-hmm. the sense of almost history as being a geological time frame. It goes on its own pace. This war is simply another little tiny step in the historical process. And it's almost, not almost, they felt like I did. I didn't have any control over it. The only control I had was over my immediate situation. Mm-hmm. I was going to do the best with that. This was probably my one little statement out of my one little world there mm-hmm. to let somebody know. Lyndon Johnson, well, yes, I guess he read the letter. Let somebody know how I felt with the signature at the end of that letter. And I at least clarified and got a response back mm-hmm. from some other person. Mm-hmm. Did it make a difference? I don't think it made a difference. Mm-hmm. It made maybe a personal difference mm-hmm. more than anything else. I didn't have a lot of contact with the military. I didn't have very much contact with USAID or CORDS. Mm-hmm. What little contact I had was favorable, a la Mr. Burroughs, the few people, the few GIs that I knew. I saw some things. I saw atrocities. I saw things that I'm not proud of having been of American culture. Mm-hmm. It happened on both sides. I never felt betrayed. I did feel a sense of betrayal, though, politically, nationally, by my country, but not to a great emotional extent. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed in my country. I felt that I, when I was over here trying to make a decision mm-hmm. Whether to join IVS, mm-hmm. and I was making a personal decision to try to find out where I stood with Vietnam, mm-hmm. I made that personal decision. I'm an American. I did what I felt was the best thing to do. I didn't run away. Mm-hmm. I made an intellectual, emotional decision. I went to Vietnam to find out what it was all about. I can't say that I found out what it was all about, but I found out what a little bit it was about. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was some truthful, honest, viable exchange between the two cultures, American, mm-hmm. Vietnamese, Montagnard. That might be somewhat of a long response to that kind
of
long
question. No, I'm interested. Even the questions are ephemeral. One has to start somewhere to get somewhere, but the question itself doesn't have an answer.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when language is used, it makes a connection on its own. You mentioned that they said, we could use some more IBSers. Now, let me give you a perspective on that I'd love you to respond to.
Okay.
And that is that there will always be an argument that the United States could have won the war. Mm-hmm. Now, winning the war, of course, to people who talk like that, they don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by winning? What's your definition? They don't deal with those issues. When they talk about winning, they mean stopping the North Vietnamese from taking over the South. That's their idea of victory. Mm-hmm. What that means, like for example, having a Vietnamese government that kind of looks like El Salvador, they're not interested in that. Mm-hmm. If that would have been an outcome, that outcome means nothing to them. There will be those who said, we never should have fought in South Vietnam, we just should have invaded North Vietnam. Nothing mattered in the South. But there will be others who will say, had we only fought a better counterinsurgent war, if we'd won more hearts and minds instead of blown them up along with their villages and pigs, cows, that we could have won. I would imagine you thought very little about those issues, that they meant very, very little to you. But the real issue, on that level, is when you saw, from even after that year, what you saw in Vietnam, you felt that the United States was not doing the right thing. What was the right thing that the U.S. should have been doing? Other than get out. And you didn't feel did you feel in 67 that we should just, what we were doing was just bad and we should leave?
I felt that in 66 and probably even earlier than that, that what we were doing was the wrong approach. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a strong sense of getting out, mm-hmm. but I certainly had a strong sense of getting in deeper, mm-hmm. And I was definitely opposed against that. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any forward motion. Mm-hmm. Literally, mm-hmm. when I was talking about like the war and the politics seemed mm-hmm. to be over here, mm-hmm. and we seemed to be here, mm-hmm. and we didn't give much thought to it except when the war and politics interjected into our lives. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a strong sense at all that anything was being accomplished by the war.
If it had been, if there was some kind of steady progress, would you have been as critical of the cost? That is, if it looked like the Republic of South Vietnam mm-hmm. was becoming more secure, that all that bombing and all those soldiers and all that fighting and everything was actually having a positive effect, and that Vietnam was evolving into something that was different, it was changing, things were getting better or something like that. Would the cost have seemed worthwhile to you?
I don't think so. I think back and think of the many hours that I spent living and eating with the Vietnamese and the Montagnards, the many, many hours that we spent in talking. And politics were so far from our mind, but I was always thinking about, and having done some traveling in my Air Force family before, I would often think, now here is a culture, this is a culture, it is a unique culture. I'm from a unique culture, the Montagnards were from a unique culture. They're living together, we're living together. We're not hurting each other, we're not tearing each other up. It would be nice if we could expand this. If this could be the politics mm-hmm. of the society. If this could be the politics of the nation, mm-hmm. and I felt that it was impossible. I felt that we were in the United States, South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, were in a no-win situation. I felt that no matter what went on, what continued, mm-hmm. whether there was progress meaning you gained more territory or not. It was strictly a no-win situation. Nobody, I didn't see how anybody could win anything from this approach, from a war approach. And I was always sorrowful. We were always sorrowful. How wouldn't it be nice? And literally, right out of the 60s, wouldn't it be nice to lay down our arms, you know, and put a flower? And I remember we get some of the music over there, and I had a little radio. And the Vietnamese loved the American music. And probably we talked more about politics from the standpoint of the music that was coming out of those times than anything. And we get our frustrated. We listen to a little bit. I didn't listen to much, but sometimes we listen to it and get our batteries out. And the Vietnamese, were always amused by the, not amused, but sensitive by what was really being said in some of those songs, especially these songs where we're going to stop the war and the flower people and the flower children. They were somewhat amused by it, but they were always talking about
the Waukee.
Exactly right. but they talked about the message. They would talk about the message that was there. And I said, geez, man, it would be nice if we could use these for messages rather than stuff that comes from the sky.
Mm.
I guess our bottom line, my bottom line, was that it was so tragic. I mean, it was so tragic. It was so sad when the bullets would come. I mean, it would tear you apart. I mean, you know, I don't have to say that to a recorder. I mean, anybody who's been through that experience has to know it. But, you know, it's not a unique experience with me. It is a human experience. Anytime a human population, an individual or a race or a culture are decimated or they're put down because of any number of reasons, militarily, on the ground, and then you become insensitive. If you're fighting, you often become insensitive. And then I think when the insensitivity becomes part of the program, the mission, whatever, you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to be gained. Mm-hmm. So, in one respect, I'm really happy from the standpoint that my stay in Vietnam, in the culture, with the Vietnamese and with the multi-arts, never became a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt, with the few contacts I had with USAID or with the military, I never, ever, ever had an individual or a group of people in the military or USAID pressure me, sermonize at me. I had a lot of questions why I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you here? Tell me, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
And but I never had any pressure from them. And so I never felt betrayed by anyone, except as my initial, or one of my statements back, that somewhat by my country. But I'm a staunch American. I love my country.
Mm-hmm.
And we, individuals, countries, cultures, make mistakes, et cetera. So we make mistakes.
Well, how did you feel in 1975 when the war ended?
I guess I just felt absolutely amazed that here we've come full circle from so many years of bitterness and fighting, etc. I guess that I felt more than anything a sense of relief for my Vietnamese compatriots and friendships over there. I never felt, and I don't think my Vietnamese friends and multi-art friends ever conveyed to me a sense of dread about being taken over by the communists. I did have one of my Vietnamese teachers who came from the north, and he was adamantly against the northern intrusion into Vietnam. But I never felt a sense of urgency that it would be the end of the world if this happened. And they were all of the people with whom I taught, the males, or most of the people, all of the adults, did not want to see North Vietnam take over South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never a sermon. I just hope the war never comes to our village. I hope, I just hope we stay as we are. But they knew that their own government would just corrupt up to the hilt.
Mm-hmm.
And someone would say, well, that's the way it is. And this one man in particular would say, I'd rather have this than North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
But almost all of them spoke very highly of Ho Chi Minh. I love the guy. And
well, I think that just about says everything.
Yeah.
In its own little complex way, it shows, well, my own feeling simply, I don't care if it's on the table, is that there's a historical arc in Vietnam, and most Vietnamese knew where it was going.
Yeah.
And that arc started in 45 with a revolution in which Ho was elected president.
Yeah.
And the non-communist Vietnamese were at a disadvantage, and they've always said, we never were able to recover.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they didn't have a patron-client state in the South, the American influx distorted everything of the South Vietnamese government.
I agree.
And there wasn't any there anymore. And it was without some drastic thing that the U.S. could do, which would always be force, not politics, would have been hopeless because of the political nature of the situation. There was a political process at work in Vietnam that had nothing to do with the war. And none of it could happen in a natural way because of 45 and, I guess you call it 65. Between that victory and our massive intervention, which we had to, in 65 the country would have gone to the VC, not even the North Vietnamese much. And I guess here what I felt, especially since I could read the analysis reports when I was young, it seemed that we had stepped in the middle of Vietnamese history that was moving in a direction which we knew wasn't good, but which was moving. And we inserted a military force to stop that history cold, right where it was. And you can't do that. And we learned that, I think, in Somalia and in Bosnia. We're not trying to change the whole political system. We know our troops can't do that. And it's funny, it takes a draft dodger to, you know, to come to that realization. And I'm saying that facetiously in quotes, because I've written a letter to Bill Clinton, and he did exactly what I wanted. He normalized relations. I mean, my letter had no more effect than yours. But it came at a time where they did read it and they did circulate it, and I'm glad. And I'm glad what happened happened. But one of my arguments is that the North Vietnamese became more Stalinist because of the war they had with us. And therefore, whatever they became, like all other processes, if Vietnam became a bad government with a very bad economic policy after the war, it was in part because of the war. And had Ho Chi Minh been able to be president of a living when the country became unified early, maybe some of those things wouldn't happen, and maybe some of them were.
Yeah.
And we won't ever know that. And but I'd like to think the mistake we made was misunderstanding that arc of Vietnamese history, and living with that.
Uh-huh. And that's what I was. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. Is why I was saying that the Vietnamese that I dealt with, they seemed to have a sense of history. Mm-hmm. They seemed to know what was going historically. They knew their past.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, it was like almost like, you know, there is a process, a historical process that we have set upon. A long time in the past, in the most immediate modern times, 45, Dien Bien Phu, there is this historic process. And your interjection, our, the United States interjection, isn't going to do much. It's going to cause a lot of heartache and pain. It's not going to put a crack in this historical arc that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to have a sense of that.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have a sense that if you put a million men, if you bring 2 million men into this country, it's not going to make much difference. It's not going to make too much difference at all.
But I think the sad thing for Americans, they feel that if we had gone whole hog, if we had been more aggressive, we would have won something. And I think all we would have won was to impose our will onto their history.
And I agree with you.
You never know, you know. As you say, when you say a good American, I mean, we want to win. Americans like winning. We don't like losing. We sure as heck don't want to be on a losing side. And we don't also, I think the war dehumanized America to a certain extent. It certainly forced very young Americans to face impossible situations, morally and ethnically. And I'm very ashamed that the war did that.
Mm-hmm.
Because from World War II, we had the John Wayne image of America being great, and we exploited that. Intentionally or not, and sent a very young army to do to fight in a very terrible situation.
Sad. I mean, some of the scenes, you know, the scenes and the pictures and the TV things, the pictures mainly, it just, like you say, the young men, the young women who went there, and having to, forcing those people into those moral choices and dilemmas and ironies, the ironies that were always there, it just, it was heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I mean, there's no particular reason, only it's just historical record. You mentioned that you were aware of atrocities. Was that something around 68, or was that something you just casually saw?
Okay, when I say atrocities, it was basically came out of just before and just after the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I speak of atrocities, I talk about before Tet.
Mm-hmm.
There were incidents of assassination, but they were rare.
Mm-hmm.
The Viet Cong came in several times during the year and into the town, and they would assassinate people. And there were some came very close to our school. One of our parents were assassinated. Just came into the outlying village there and assassinated somebody and then left.
Mm-hmm. Just came in. And it's heartbreaking. When Ted came along, what Ted did to Vietnam as a whole, but what Ted did particularly to Pleiku was, it was terrible. I mean, it was, it's hard to find words.
Mm-hmm.
Our school was a couple blocks from me. I was living by myself at that time, and just came in from a Ted party that night.
Mm-hmm.
Had spent it with Dom and his sister and a bunch of other, she made up a great Ted dinner,
mm-hmm.
and we had some beers and everything, and then that night, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and military out shooting guns off, and firecrackers were popping, not a lot of firecrackers, but
mm-hmm.
lots of guns were going off. About 2 o'clock in the morning, everything got real quiet, and I walked about, six, seven, 8 blocks up some dirt roads up to my little place. And I remember coming in to the house, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and closing my doors. There were some wood frame door, a frame door, very similar to that one, and I had just gotten into bed. When all of a sudden, my front door blew wide open, and that was the beginning of the Tet Offensive. The mortar round had come in and just landed it fairly close by.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next 3 days, Pleiku was under some pretty heavy fighting.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked about irony. I talked about irony, right? Here was this war going on. I mean, bombs and bullets and explosions going on. And when it became daylight and the fighting had moved further away, you could stand out in the middle of the street, and you could watch the bombing, you know, you could hear the bullets, you could hear the tanks firing over here,
mm-hmm.
and it was, I remember just standing there, I can't believe it, people are getting killed right over here,
mm-hmm.
people are getting killed over here, people are getting killed over here, I'm alive. That night there were a lot of mortars that came in that part of my town up there, and I had mentioned to you earlier in the conversation about the English for Today books.
Mm-hmm.
I had just received about, 20 boxes of them from America,
mm-hmm.
filled with English for Today books.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my front doors went wide open, I went in the little back room, had a little kind of storage room, and I stacked up all these books, boxes of books, and got in behind them. I had a little tape recorder, it was bigger than that, I just set it up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started talking into it and said, you could hear all this stuff going on, and I said, I'm crouched down behind some English for Today books, and for some reason there seems to be something going on outside. And anyway, like just this picture, the irony, this one picture of a little girl. Let's see if I can find it real quick. This girl right here.
Mm-hmm.
This is about a block up. We're sitting in behind this house, and she's holding one of her siblings. I don't know where her family is, but she's got her stuff here, and there were about six or seven of us down in behind this house. It was daytime. On the other side of this house is a dirt road, and on the other side of the dirt road is our school.
Mm-hmm.
And the fighting's going all around the school. And here we are just sitting there, just waiting, you know, just waiting to see what's happening. I look around the corner, I see the school, those panes of glass we put in are non-existent
mm-hmm.
anymore, and they're fighting. I can see dead bodies out on the school grounds. There's a tank down here that's been blown up. There's a tank rumbling through the old Chinese school. Up here, there's another tank. And we're just sitting, like I say, huh? We listened to the war together.
Mm-hmm.
Just sitting there. And the irony of that, all this death is going on behind us, and here we have life here.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me to the point where I was almost numb,
mm-hmm.
where I felt like I was completely, had no control on what was happening. None whatsoever, other than myself and my immediate surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was wondering where how my friends were doing. And the first day was the Tet attacks was very heavy around that area. And eventually, I walked down to my other friends where we had Tet, and that's that scene where he was in his bunker,
mm-hmm.
and he and his sister and her little ones were in the bunker. And so we spent a fair amount of time in that bunker,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd get up and make rice or something like that. And then after it was over, 3 days later, it was just like there was this big silence. Descended upon the town, and a lot of smoke, and then I remember Dom and I, and I think Mr. Yup, Mr. Trum, we walked over to the school, and we were just silent. Our little janitor, we had a little janitor who lived in a shack behind, he was dead,
no.
And his wife had put his body on the concrete platform under one of the eaves of our school,
mm-hmm.
and had him covered up, and she was wisping flies from his eyes. And there were numerous Viet Cong that were dead, strewn across the grounds. And several of our classrooms were blown up, and our little office building had been hit by a mortar, and it was shattered and blown. But it was there, it was a very, it was almost like a very tiring experience. It's like you'd been awake for days and days and days, and you got over here, and you felt like there was, gee, there was such uselessness, and what can we do? And you know, there's really no use to do anything. And when we walked back to this house right here, across the street, I'll never forget it. Most of the little buildings around, this was a concrete structure, most of the little buildings were just shacks. They were all smashed and burning and stuff like this. On that morning, after we had seen the bodies and the school was not completely, but shattered and things like that, and we walked back across that road, and I saw a Vietnamese woman, an old Ba, sitting there picking out the good bricks and stacking up the good bricks that weren't broken from this shack and putting them there. The old Ba picking the good bricks out of this shattered structure. I mean, within moments of it, within hours of it having been destroyed, and then and bodies still lying around, and a sense of life goes on, a sense of there perhaps for her is some importance, a sense of no matter how defeated you can become, you can still lift yourself up. And that image, you know, it remains to me this day. I'll never forget that image of her and rebuilding from the instant that something was destroyed. And those are one of many images that I learned and saw in Vietnam. And so when I sit here and talk with you, or in those rare moments when I reflect upon Vietnam, I don't reflect upon the burned bodies that I saw, and I don't reflect upon the atrocities or the madness. I reflect upon the sunsets and this little girl and the old Ba picking the bricks out. And my good friends sitting around by candlelight drinking beer and singing songs. Those are the images that come back.
Yes, but the thing that makes me a pacifist is that if everyone's going to start all over, why destroy everything in the first place? Since it rarely has the objectives that you sought.
Yes, right.
That it just seems so futile. Force seems so futile a way of... I remember once the Turks thought that they could eliminate the Armenian internal threat. And you were in Izmir, so about that. And... they ended up killing maybe, you know, not even deliberately in a kind of German or Khmer Rouge way. They managed to eliminate hundreds of thousands of Armenians. And the result of this is no Turks safe anywhere in the world from some Armenian terrorists. You know, they've got the land and they control the Armenians, but there's no peace, there's no safety that comes from it. And the Bosnians and the Croatians, and they're all going to learn that. And in the long run, why do it in the first place if it isn't going to come to anything? And you know, every dead VC is as poignant as every dead housekeeper and janitor, since they had the same families. They're all doing something other than that, you know, before the war, and would have been fine just going on doing that.
I wish we could find this key to humanity that at least history hasn't taught us, and that is what you just said. I don't think we can point to any type of conflict, mass exterminations, atrocities, where we have to take over countries or where we have to do this militarily, that's led to some positive effect. Territorially, yes. World War II, you maybe could say, yeah, well, gee, if we hadn't done this, maybe that. But there seems to be something involved in the human character that won't allow it to approach a conflict quite often without a military solution, without a quote of military solution, or a killing, or something like that.
Well, the sad thing is for Vietnam, which was supposedly part of the containment theory, it was George F. Kennan who said that this is not the way the containment theory is supposed to work. In Congress, he testified in 1965 that we should not send more combat troops to Vietnam, that that's not what containment,
And communism, and I don't say communism, I'd say Marxist-Leninism, is evil, it doesn't work, it's self-perpetuating, it's rude, it's all these other nasty things. But it's not going to go away by fighting brush fire wars. Brush fire wars aren't good containment. And unfortunately, they ended up containing us. Because at very little cost to themselves, the Marxist-Leninists in China and the Soviet Union got us to put all our resources and destroy our economy in a place that everybody knew was meaningless for any real national interest. And that was a tremendous success for them. And the only revenge we get is then the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan and did the same thing with our example right in front of them, the way we had the French.
Yeah.
You know,
incredible.
Except they had no home front. They had no Jane Fonda. They had no limitations. And they raped their veterans in the same way. They put their veterans in the same, put their soldiers in the same conditions, committed more atrocities, which meant forcing more and more people into intolerable situations. And then when they came home, stiffed them even more than we stiffed our own.
Yeah.
And learned nothing. And now they're Vietnam, Afghanistan veterans groups, because they're the only two people who've experienced that same thing.
Yeah.
Only it just keeps going on and on. I mean, imagine the Revolutionary Guard for Saddam Hussein thought they were fighting for their country, you know. And it's just a tragedy. And that's the word. You used it, and it's true. It's just tragic because it's needless in a humane way. When we think of human history, it's meaningless. But there was a theory that the very first civilizations in Mesopotamia were imperialistic. So it may be human nature, you know. And we're fighting against it, and maybe we get a reward later for fighting. Now, I made you this way, God might say, but you were supposed to get better. That was, you know, like, yeah, and that's a really interesting factor. When did you leave Vietnam? When did your tour with IBSN?
July of 68.
Okay, July of 68. So was that part of the, did that have anything to do with IVS's post-TET re-examination? Because a lot of people are told, well, you know, you can leave now, you know, if you feel that the situation is intolerable.
Not
you in particular, but were you aware of that re-evaluation? Did you get
I wasn't,
enough? You just weren't close
no,
enough.
No, I wasn't hearing, I don't think I heard anything about a re-evaluation and why we were there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about that.
Did your parents find out you were okay? How did that happen after?
They were worried. Needless, most people were, but there was no communication, and they were, of course, hearing all the stuff on TV and Pleiku was one of the places under heavy attack.
Yeah,
and all I could do was, after the attacks were finished, and then waiting several days after that, I did go out to the air base, and I had a Mr. Burroughs, and he had some friends who were in communication, and they were able to. I asked him a favor. He was able to simply make a short telegram to my parents telling them that I was okay. And so that was probably about 10 days after the attacks were over. My mom was just completely, she was frantic. One reason is because of something like this, if I can find it. Because they were in Washington, and they were getting all kinds of things. Here's a picture. This is from the Washington Post.
Yeah, I'll write that down.
And I think it's dated right there at the bottom.
See, this is the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for that tiny black print down there.
Right.
Washington Post, Monday, 2/5, 68, and it's the dateline Saigon, February 4th.
And she
Central Highlands, a town of Pleiku. My God.
Yeah. And she was seeing things like this. Well, she was wondering where I was. Well. You see that picture?
And there's where I was.
There's where you were. And a lot of these are Montagnard people. And this is that soldier I was taking apart.
Right.
I took a picture of him. He was not very happy with me, but I asked if I could take the picture. He said yes. So, anyway.
Are all these VC? Or are they just
some VC
some
and many Montagnards, but you know, what can you tell about
a
body?
Yes,
body counts, right?
After that period of time, too.
That
really impressed a friend of mine who was just arrived in Vietnam for TET, and he said, you know, he turned a corner and he saw the bodies in full bloat, and he said, I knew right then and there that the war we were winning yesterday when I left the United States was his lost assignments.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just incredible, incredible line. But so they found out. You know, your father must have tried to gut that one out, you know, knowing this.
Yeah, they were both worried. My dad is somewhat austere and quiet, but.
How did he feel about you joining IBS?
I think he was surprised And especially in conjunction with the fact that he had just come back, he was over there 63 to 64, mm-hmm. and I went in 66. But I never got any speeches or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful, son.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful. Because he'd been there, and he knew that things were, he knew things at that time weren't quite what were being told and said.
Mm-hmm.
And just be careful, son. And but having been involved in somewhat, having been a very individual son, somewhat of on the quiet loner side myself, and having done a lot of, having had a lot of unusual hobbies and gone out in the line and taking not risks, calculated risks, and some of the sports that I did, and having made some decisions to do and explore the things that I did in the wilderness and the way I did it.
Mm-hmm.
They were surprised, but they knew that nothing that they were going to say was going to keep me from going to Vietnam, but mm-hmm. Mom was particularly worried. Mom was very, very worried about the whole situation and couldn't understand why that situation was taking place, but understood when I made that decision. She understood from having known me, having, you know, I'm her son,
mm-hmm.
and having known me from the way I made decisions in the past, she understood that it was probably something Jim has to do or had to do. And so she was just thankful everybody came back in one piece.
She sent both her husband and her son to Vietnam,
yeah.
and they both came back.
Yeah, how about that?
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a brother
uh-huh.
who is 10 years younger than I am, and
mm-hmm.
I have a sister who's about the middle between us.
Mm-hmm.
And both my brother and sister live in Merced right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
what do they do?
My brother works, has a little postal business
mm-hmm.
In Merced, and my sister is a homemaker
mm-hmm.
and during the summer, and then she's a school teacher during the years.
During the year?
Yeah.
And how did you feel as July approached? I mean, July was the end of your contract.
Yeah, end of my contract.
Uh-huh.
I was getting very sad
mm-hmm.
about having to leave, and I knew that I had the option to
mm-hmm.
stay if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I still had this unresolved thing with my Merced draft board,
mm-hmm.
and it was making me feel very. It was upsetting, but it was an unresolved thing
mm-hmm.
that was still out there. And coming back with IBS wouldn't resolve it. And I felt that probably my time in Vietnam was finished,
mm-hmm.
even though I could have easily come back.
Mm-hmm.
And as that time approached, my nickname was Mr. Nostalgie.
Mr. Nostalgic?
Yeah, that was
oh, Nostalgie in French.
You're right, that's
yes.
what they nicknamed me.
Uh-huh.
And I got that nickname early in the game. Because there was a sense of aloneness,
mm-hmm.
but not being alone,
mm-hmm.
but just a sense of aloneness, you know,
mm-hmm.
this sense of being apart and having an aloneness aura, Mr. Nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
Nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, had a big party at school
mm-hmm.
and lined up. This is the school that we, after the Tet Offensive, we went back and took us a month, 6 weeks to repair and get it all fixed up. And then when it came within weeks, we had a really big party at the school. We lined up all the desks, and families and students brought food over, and we got one of my boys brought over, I don't know where he got the electric amp.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little generator outside going, and some of the kids played guitars. They borrowed these electric guitars, never knew where they got them from, and
mm-hmm.
I had an amp, and they played music, and we danced. And it was a lot of fun, dancing
mm-hmm.
with some of my girl students,
mm-hmm.
and I was always wondering what I would learn next in the social scheme of Vietnam. And always just had so much fun learning these things
mm-hmm.
and dancing with my students, dancing with my parents, and always the proprieties of, like, you know, it was okay for men to hold hands and dance with each other and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't this concept that if a guy held hands with a guy that you were automatically gay or anything
right.
like that. And it was just their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And my flight out was very early in the morning, very, very early. It seems to be like about 2 in the morning. And I spent my last night in Pleiku at Mr. Dom's house and his sister's house. It was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the school party was a couple days earlier, and then I just packed up my few belongings and I went over to their house. And they, seems to me, they had borrowed a truck from some military guy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to take me out to the airport next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I remember quite a few of us, the teacher, male teacher, were there, and remember sleeping in the old bed that night, candlelight, and Lien is Mr. Dom's sister, Lien, mm-hmm. L-I-E-N. Mm-hmm. In fact, I named my first daughter, mm-hmm. Gave her Lien's middle name to mm-hmm. her, because she meant so much to me. Mm-hmm. And we had dinner that night and went to bed, and I remember sleeping in the, we had a little mat, and I slept with Dom that night, mm-hmm. and all the other guys slept in a couple more beds, and got about 2 in the morning. And didn't have any candlelight. I remember I was groping my way. I knew where the restroom was. It was outside the restroom. I was kind of groping my way and looking for belongings. And as I was walking through the dark room, I ran into Lien. Mm-hmm. She was standing there. And she gave me a big hug, mm-hmm. which is kind of almost verging on being a no-no, because she was married to a Vietnamese army captain or something like mm-hmm. that. He wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But she gave me a big, big hug, and I gave her a big hug, and she said something in Vietnamese that's very meaningful. And then I went out and got my things, and then Dom got up and put some candles on, and one of my students came over to say goodbye to me. And we got in the truck, went out to the airport. Mm-hmm. I think it was C-131, flew down to Saigon. Spent a night there, and took off to Cambodia. And that was kind of the last night there.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, just getting back to where we were in the beginning, you went back, and you still have these unresolved issues with the draft board, which was going to make you 1A. So mm-hmm. it turned out you applied for graduate school, mm-hmm. and so you went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And then by the time that was over, while that was coming to an end and you were going to be draftable again,
right.
you happened to be hiking and you were in San Andreas, and as you normally did, probably you asked around if there were any jobs.
Yes,
and
I did,
got a job teaching American Indians, which was draft exclusion. And by the time that year finished, you were too old to be drafted.
24, right.
And so you went on teaching in that to those Indians for any period
of time?
Yes,
for another year.
Another year.
And then I stayed in that county,
mm-hmm.
and taught till 71. I was married in 71. I'm now divorced,
mm-hmm.
but I was married in 71, and my wife at that time and I took off. I wanted to go out one more time. I wanted to get out into the world one more time before I tied myself down
mm-hmm.
the responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took my new wife and I. We left for a year,
mm-hmm.
and she probably pretty much thought I was insane, probably still does, but put backpacks in our pack, and we spent a year. Flew into London and then essentially hitchhiked through Western Europe and down into North Africa. Got a ferry over into Italy and then over to Greece and eventually got over to Israel. Spent a month working on kibbutz in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Saw a little of the Middle East and then came back.
What year was that?
That was 71, 72.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as good fortune would have it, and even though sometimes I'm despondent, I think these little things are meant to hurt me, or whatever. I do realize that I have had good things happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
I came back to Calaveras County looking for a job again,
mm-hmm.
and I got a job at Calaveras County,
mm-hmm.
and I've been there since 73,
mm-hmm.
teaching elementary school,
mm-hmm.
and so things worked out.
Yes, they did. When were you divorced?
I was divorced in 1990.
Mm-hmm. You have two kids? Or?
I have two girls and a boy.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a daughter, Katie Lien,
mm-hmm.
Is beginning her senior year at UC
mm-hmm.
Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And Tasha is my youngest daughter, is just finished her freshman year at Modesto Junior College.
Mm-hmm.
Going to do one more year and then go on to Sonoma State.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a son who goes into the fourth grade next year.
No, fourth grade. My goodness.
And I have taught all my children.
Uh-huh.
When they came through my when Katie and Tasha came through my program at my elementary school, I was the English literature. Thank God I got a literature major.
Yes.
I'd never get a job on a philosophy degree.
No. No.
And I taught both of them, and then I suppose that, and I may have my son next year for one class too.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah, his name is Micah David. Uh-huh. Micah David Bigelow.
And Micah from the element of the material in the rock around where he's from.
Yeah, exactly.
Carries a piece of
uh-huh.
Northern California with him wherever he goes.
Yes, you got it.
Yes.
Actually, it's MICAH.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's Micah.
Micah, right.
Yeah,
messenger
right.
of God.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Are you, you get an IBS newsletter?
I do get an IBS
mm-hmm.
newsletter, and occasionally I'll send them a donation.
Occasionally? I'm glad to hear that, because I've been lecturing people. I mean, I don't even like a lot of things that I'm just doing right now, but it's ephemeral on likeness. Yeah. It's not a thing. I mean, I think this was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
so do I.
Yeah, but it's like, hey, if you're going to get the newsletter, you got to send money. It's like PBS. You can't just listen to the NPR in particular. You can't listen to it every morning and not pay since it's member supported.
Yeah,
and the same thing is with IBS.
Yeah, we're sitting here in Burns Tower and public radio issues from this tower. They have KULP.
I was listening to it on the way in.
Public radio system. Mm-hmm.
Now, IBS, do you know, aware that IBS now is kind of, actually it's going back to its original roots with a twist. It started out largely just sending experts out from the United States. And then with the USAID contract, the manpower required other people. I think Val Peterson was the first person who was not an expert in this field. He went to Laos. And then after the Vietnam War, you know, there was the end of the USAID contract, and IBS was kind of at sea for a long time. And now it's essentially paying third country nationals and indigenous nationals to do specific kinds of work. And of course, Don will be stepping down as executive director in the next couple of weeks, but we'll still maintain the AIDS project in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
We almost bumped into each other, by the way, in Bangkok. I was so sad we couldn't get together. It was just a coincidence that we missed when I was going to Vietnam a while back.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a different kind of thing, and in a sense, I feel a sense of loss because, you know, the Peace Corps is wonderful, but it's the State Department. And one of the things that we're probing around the corners of in the study is to do something like that, isn't it almost better that it not be connected with that nation at all? And on the other hand, with the complexities and dangers of the world today, how can you go out on your own? So there's this ownness, those German hitchhikers killed in Kashmir by terrorists, and on the other hand, it's State Department people who are always being identified so directly with the U.S. government. As IBSers, did you think the Vietnamese people knew full well, at least the ones you knew, that IBS was not, that represented something different from the U.S. government?
The Vietnamese people with whom I associated, mm-hmm. I felt strongly that IBS was an entity unto its own,
mm-hmm.
and was doing something unique.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese did ask me
mm-hmm.
about the very common abbreviation, the CIA, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they felt and they expressed to me that IBS was doing something very unique,
mm-hmm.
Outside of the political realm,
mm-hmm.
outside the war realm, and outside the intelligence realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt that the Vietnamese were the most powerful with whom I associated. Felt that there was that IBS was a type of a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
The strings were either political or military or intelligently motivated.
Did you ever have an inkling that the Viet Cong knew who you were and where you lived? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Not only intuitively, not that I'm an intuitive person,
mm-hmm.
I felt that the Viet Cong could very have easily, if they wanted to, stopped my particular program or my particular influence on the Vietnamese anytime.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't take me long to come to that realization. And it kind of came in conjunction with the fact that if I wanted to go someplace, as I said earlier in the interview, mm-hmm. or if we wanted to go into the countryside,
mm-hmm.
the Vietnamese themselves always knew when it was safe to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in particular, there was one evening when we were out roaming around, and we were told by a Vietnamese civilian
mm-hmm.
that we should go back into the house. It was not safe because there were people around
mm-hmm.
and coming in. So in answer to your question, I really felt that. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had any indication to make sure that, to give me an indication that it was absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any Viet Cong knock on my door. I didn't have any, as far as I know, assassination attempts.
But there were assassinations in your neighborhood,
so
people knew. I mean, they don't know that this person is a deputy province chief, but they don't know you were there, you know, right? That's obvious, yeah.
And as I said, I lived in several places. I once lived initially by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, four of the teachers and two of the male students that we taught and
mm-hmm.
I lived together in just a room about this size.
Mm-hmm.
I lived with Dom and Leanne for a while, and then I went back to living by myself, and I was living by myself when the Tet attacks took place, and in a room about this size with a little anti-room, and open them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in and out. I walked most places. So
mm-hmm.
I think if the Viet Cong wanted to do something about me
mm-hmm.
or my influence, they could have done it any time.
What was your trip back in, was it 1988?
Yes, 1988.
What was that like? How did that come about? And
well, it was exciting. It came about because of a newsletter from Don, mm-hmm. and a close friend of mine in Murphy's, mm-hmm. and only through my having lived in Murphy's, mm-hmm. had been in the Marines in Vietnam. And I called up Don, and I had asked him, I said, you know, I'm really interested in going back, and I have a friend who has a sensitivity of Vietnam, the same as I do. He was in the Marines there. He would like to go. And Don said, hey, bring him. And so we spent, essentially, we knew about a year in advance that we were going, and mm-hmm. we had a lot of fun preparing for it, mm-hmm. getting ready for it, getting our families ready for us to be mm-hmm. gone at Christmas, mm-hmm. things like that. I was still married and had my children were fairly young. And you know, taking care of not only the paperwork, but getting ready emotionally mm-hmm. to go back to Vietnam. And of course, Bob was going back to a place that he saw in a very different light than mm-hmm. I saw from military light, but still had an appreciation for the Vietnamese people mm-hmm. and for his experience there, even though it was the Marines. Mm-hmm. And I'm not.
Was he in CAP?
What's that?
The Civil Action Platoons or
no,
Combined
he,
Action?
No, he was in Da Nang. He spent a year in Da Nang, uh-huh. but he was not in. Was not working in any of the programs. Mm-hmm. He was simply. He was military bound mm-hmm. and made forays into the jungles. Basically, a large part of his assignment was to guard the aircraft that were on the airport there.
So he had some off time in Da Nang.
Yes,
and
he saw a little bit of the country, but not mm-hmm. much.
Well, leaving him aside for a mm-hmm. moment, what was your experience when you went back?
I was able to contact Mr. Trung mm-hmm. and Mr. Dong via letter mm-hmm. and let them know well in advance that I was coming. Mr. Dong's situation is such that he will never be able to leave Vietnam. He did something that I'm not sure what, but he did something that irritated the government, the mm-hmm. communist government that came in. And it was some kind of an affiliation. It wasn't through the school when we taught, but it was some kind of affiliation that I was unaware of. Mm-hmm. And I had been told this by Mr. Viem, mm-hmm. who was a very close friend of mine. He has since died, and I did see him that during that trip. He told me that there was a political reason why Mr. Don would never be granted a visa, mm-hmm. even though he wasn't being harassed. Mm-hmm. But things were such that it would be difficult for me to see him. Mm-hmm. In fact, at that time, I was advised not to see him. Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe try to meet the other people if I could. Mm-hmm. So things were such that I was really excited, and I was, and so was Bob, but we went to Bangkok and did our Bangkok thing, and in fact, Bob and I went early, and we got up to Burma. We went up to Burma for mm-hmm. 7 days, came back. But we flew to Hanoi, and then we came, spent some time, a wonderful trip there, and then came down, flew into Hue. Mm-hmm. Or no, we flew into Da Nang, I believe, and then took a bus up to Hue. Mm-hmm. No, what was it? I can't remember.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm. But when we got to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, I had an address, a Vietnamese address, on how to get out to Mr. Dom's and Mr. Viem's house. Mm-hmm. And I had been advised, not only by Don Luce, to be very cautious, mm-hmm. but he said, fine, you go do what you have to do. I had still had some minor language skills, mm-hmm. and I didn't feel afraid or anything like that. And so Bob went with me, and we took a sequel driver. We hired a sequel driver, and he took us up to the northeast part of Saigon. And got out to the community, and we were talking to the community people, and I had this sequel driver drop us off well before the supposed address, and I had a map, mm-hmm. had a map of Saigon, and I was able to find the street on this map. Mm-hmm. And I located Dom, mm-hmm. and it was just so totally emotional. Mm-hmm. I mean, he and his wife and some of his children living back in this little hovel, you know, mm-hmm. down this alleyway, and when I came up, and I was so, you know, being so far away mm-hmm. from America, mm-hmm. and finding him in this large town, and you know, we saw each other. He knew had got my letter. Mm-hmm. He knew I might be able to get there. He was nervous mm-hmm. about me being there, but we just hugged each other. His wife came out. She had the maid rose. We rose. I only stayed for a few minutes mm-hmm. because he said it would not be good for you to be known to be here mm-hmm. still. And you know, it was just very emotional mm-hmm. meeting. When we went back, I can't remember which hotel we were staying at, Dom contacted Viem and Trung, the only other two friends that were in Ho Chi Minh City, mm-hmm. And they were able to come down to the hotel, and I met them out, not in the hotel, but I met them out in the plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat and talked for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Don was there for a while because I wanted to ask, I was trying to get Vim, I'd been trying to help Vim to get back to, or get to the United
mm-hmm.
States. So Don came out, he spoke Vietnamese fluently, and we tried to do some conversing for a while, and then Don went on in. So I had a very wonderful meeting with Vim
mm-hmm.
and Trung there in the plaza. So
this is the name of the hotel you're saying?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
What are it, Caravel?
Oh, but the plaza where the statue
yeah.
of Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah,
yeah, it's right out on
right out
on Dong Khoi.
Yeah.
Like right at the
I
end of Dong
Khoi. I think the name was hotel was the Caravel that we were
saying. Yeah, there's the Caravel,
uh-huh.
the Continental and the
yes.
Rex are all kind of
right
like
there,
this.
Exactly.
And then there's that thing, and then there's that over to the
uh-huh.
other side towards
yeah.
the Rex
yeah.
is that thing of Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really an open area, God knows the things that go on there.
Exactly,
it's wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
And we were a little nervous, but Don said it was okay. He
mm-hmm.
said it was fine, and
mm-hmm.
he said the way you approached it was fine. And
mm-hmm.
And he said I don't think there's going to be any bad things happening. And it was fine, as
mm-hmm.
it worked out. And so we were only there for a couple of nights in
mm-hmm.
Saigon. That was when we left Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we took that Russian aircraft from Hanoi, which took us down to Da Nang. I think it's where we landed next. It was Da Nang. And we flew right over Pleiku, and I could recognize the town because I had been in so many aircraft above
mm.
that town,
right.
and I was there, and I said, Bob, Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And
end of interview with Jimmy Bigelow.
Yeah, hold on. Yellow button right here.
Hi, Bob.
Bob.
Bob.